And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's December 29th. 363rd day of the year. Two more days. And this year is history. On this day in 875, Charles de Gaulle, King of the France, is crowned as Holy Roman Emperor, Charles II. Now, the interesting thing is, it wasn't the Roman Empire. It wasn't holy. But that's neither here nor there. 1170, Thomas Becket, Archbishop of Canterbury, is assassinated inside Canterbury Cathedral by followers of King Henry II. He became a saint and martyr in the Anglican Communion in the Catholic Church. Now, was he a saint? From everything I've read, not just no, but hell no, but that's neither here nor there. 1503, the Battle of Garigliano, fought between a Spanish army under Gonzalo Fernandez de Cordoba and a French army commanded by Ludovico II, Marquis of Saluzzo. The French and Spanish armies were separated by the Garigliano River, about 60 kilometers north of Naples. Both armies camped in a marshy and unhealthy area. The Spanish tried to cross the river using a makeshift bridge, but failed. The French, based at the river's mouth near the ruins of Mantumae, enjoyed the advantage of an accessible supply base in the nearby port of Gaeta. Now, while the Spanish commander hesitated as to whether to attack or retreat, he got reinforcements from Naples, led by Bartolomeo de Alviano and Orsini. Decided to move some units in order to convince Ludovico that he was retreating toward the Volturno River. But Cordoba devised a stratagem to cross the river using bridges made out of boats and barrels, which he built in the castle of Mondragon. During the night of December 27th, 28th, Spanish brought the bridging materials into a place near the castle of Suillo, where the French couldn't see them. De Alviano, commander of the Spanish vanguard, had the construction begin at dawn, and by 10, 4,000 Spaniards had crossed the river. Well, the 300 Norman crossbowmen in Suillo didn't notice the move, so Gonzalo de Cordoba was able to cross the river with 2,000 more, including 200 horsemen led by Prospero Colonna. Then he ordered an attack on the French bridge. When the Alviano's troops reached Suillo, the crossbowmen fled toward Castello Forte, where they met 300 French troops. They also fled, allowing de Alviano to occupy the area. Now, the French had a number of ill soldiers in their camp. Long and the short of it was, the Spanish won. And that victory was decisive as the offensive capability of the French army was destroyed. After some days of siege, the French surrendered. And the Spanish gained total supremacy over the Kingdom of Naples. That would last for several centuries. In 1508, Portuguese forces under the command of Francisco de Almeida attack Camvat at the Battle of Dubol. 1607, Indian Princess Pocahontas saves Captain John Smith from murder. 1778, American Revolutionary War. 3,000 British soldiers under the command of Lieutenant Colonel Archibald Campbell capture Savannah, Georgia. Unfortunately, for all concerned, they gave it back. 1812, USS Constitution, under the command of Captain William Bainbridge, captures the HMS Java off the coast of Brazil after a three-hour battle. 1835, the Treaty of Nuuachota is signed, ceding all the lands of the Cherokee East and the Mississippi to the U.S. 1845, the money that was paid to the Cherokee chief was apparently buried and has never been found. I'm an amateur treasure hunter as well. 1845, the U.S. annexes the Republic of Texas. In 1860, the launch of the HMS Warrior with their combination of screw propeller, iron hull, and iron armor renders all previous warships obsolete. 1874, the military coup of General Martinez Campos in Sagunto ends the failed First Spanish Republic, and the monarchy is restored as Prince Alfonso is proclaimed King of Spain. 1876, the Ashtabula River Railroad disaster occurs. 64 are injured and 92 die in Ashtabula, Ohio. Now, that disaster happened because of the failure of a bridge over the Ashtabula River near the town of Ashtabula in Ohio. A train of the Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railway carrying 160 passengers passed over the bridge as it failed, and all but the lead locomotive went into the river. The train's oil lanterns and coal fire heating stove set the wooden cars on fire. Firefighters declined to extinguish the flames, leaving individuals to try to pull survivors from the wreck. And many who survived the actual crash died in the fire. 92 people, approximately, give or take, died. It was the worst railroad accident in the U.S. in the 19th century. And it was the worst rail accident in U.S. history until the great train wreck of 1918. Later investigations showed the bridge had been improperly designed by the railroad company president, poorly constructed and inadequately inspected. As a result of the accident, a hospital was built in the town and a federal system set up to formally investigate railroad accidents. All righty. See what else we got. 1890, Wounded Knee Massacre on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. 300 Lakota Sioux are killed by the U.S. Cavalry, United States 7th Cavalry Regiment. That was Custer's unit. 1911, of course, by that time he was long since dead. Mongolia gains independence from the Qing Dynasty, enthroning 8th Jeb Tsunamba Kutugtu as Khagan of Mongolia. 1911, Sun Yat-sen becomes a provisional president of the Republic of China. Formally takes office January 1, 1912. 1913, Cecil B. DeMille starts filming Hollywood's first feature film, The Squaw Man. 1916, A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, the first novel of James Joyce, is published as a book by American publishing house B.W. Hoopsis, after its serialization in The Egoist, which was done in 1914 and 15. 1930, Sir Muhammad Iqbal's presidential address in Allahabad introduces the two-nation theory and outlines a vision for the creation of Pakistan. 1934, Japan renounces the Washington Naval Treaty of 1922 and the London Naval Treaty of 1930. 1937, the Irish Free States replaced by a new state called Ireland with the adoption of a new constitution. 1940, World War II and the Second Great Fire of London, the Luftwaffe firebombs London, kills almost 200 civilians. 1949, KC2XAK of Bridgeport, Connecticut becomes the first ultra-high-frequency television station to operate a daily schedule. 1972, Eastern Airlines Flight 401, which is a Lockheed L-1011 TriStar, crashes in the Florida Everglades on approach to Miami International Airport in Florida. Of the 176 on board, 101 are killed. Now, interestingly enough, one of the crew had crawled into the hold to try to repair something. He died. And he haunted other aircraft. And pieces of this aircraft were used on other aircraft And he went to those other aircraft as well. Quite an interesting story. 1975, a bomb explodes at LaGuardia Airport in New York City. Kills 11, injures 74. 1989, Czech writer, philosopher, and dissident Václav Havel is elected the first post-communist president of Czechoslovakia. 1889, the Nikkei 225 for the Tokyo Stock Exchange hits an all-time intraday high of 38,957.44 and closing high of 38,915.87. That serves as the apex of the Japanese asset price bubble. 1992, Fernando Collor de Mello, president of Brazil, tries to resign amidst the corruption charges. But before he can resign, he's impeached. 1994, Turkish Airlines Flight 278, a Boeing 737-400, crashes on approach to the Van Ferret Midland Airport in Van, Turkey. Of the 76 on board, 57 are killed. 1996, Guatemalan leaders of the Guatemalan National Revolutionary Unity sign a peace accord ending a 36-year civil war. 1997, Hong Kong begins to kill all the city's 1.2 5 million chickens to stop the spread of a potentially deadly influenza strain. A lot of folks said that was a foul approach to take. 1998, leaders of the Khmer Rouge apologized for the 1970s genocide in Cambodia that killed over 1 million people. Yeah, an apology really made everybody feel better. 2003, the last known speaker of Akala Sami dies, rendering that language extinct. For those that are not familiar with it, the Akala Sami is a Sami language. It was spoken in the Sami villages of Akel in the inland parts of the Kola Peninsula in Russia. It was formerly erroneously regarded as a dialect of Akeldin Sami, but it's recently become recognized as an independent language most closely related to its western neighbor, Skoit Sami. It's the most endangered, the Akala Sami is the most endangered eastern Sami language. On December 29, 2003, Maria Sergina, the last fluent native speaker of that language, died. Now, as of 2011, there were two people, both about 70, with some knowledge of the language. They live in the village of Yona. So even languages can become extinct. 2006, the UK settles its Anglo-American loan, post-World War II loan debt. 2012, a Tupolev Tu-204 airliner crashes in a ditch between the airport fence and the M3 highway after overshooting a runway at Inkovo International Airport in Moscow, kills five and leaves three others critically injured. 2013, a suicide bomb attack on the Volgograd 1 railway station at the southern Russian city of Volgograd kills 18 and wounds 40 others. 2013, seven-time Formula One champion Michael Schumacher suffers a massive head injury while skiing in the French Alps. And in 2020, a large explosion at the airport in the southern Yemeni city of Aden kills at least 22 and wounds 50. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances, Christian Feast Day, David, king and prophet in the Catholic and the Lutheran churches, Jonathan, prince of Israel and David's friend, Thomas Becket, Trophimus of Ares, Constitution Day in Ireland, Independence Day in Mongolia, fifth day of Christmas in the Western Christianity, and the fourth day of Kwanzaa in the U.S. All right, let's see what else we might have. In 1539, St. Jacob's Church burns to the ground after getting hit by lightning. 1541, Isabella of Poland and King Ferdinand of Austria signed the Treaty of Gaylu. 1558, Charles V, King of Spain and Holy Roman Emperor, is buried in El Escorial, San Lorenzo de El Escorial in Spain. Let's see. 1782, the first nautical almanac in the U.S. is published by Samuel Stearns of Boston. 1786, in the French Revolution, the Assembly of Notables is convoked. In 1806, Thomas Dibdin's pantomime Harlequin and Mother Goose, which stars Joseph Grimaldi, probably known as the greatest clown in history, before you look at the folks that sit in our House of Representatives. And this was his most famous clown performance. And it opened at Covent Garden Theatre in London on this date in 1806. 1813, the British burned Buffalo, New York during the War of 1812. 1837, the Canadian militia destroy the Carolina, a U.S. steamboat docked at Buffalo. Oh. Excuse me. 1837, a steam-powered threshing machine is patented in Winthrop, Maine. 1841, King and Grand Duke Wilhelm II installs the Order of Eichenkrone. 1848, during Polk's administration, gas lights are first installed at the White House. 1851, the first American Young Men's Christian Association, that's the YMCA, chapters opened in Boston. 1852, Emma Snodgrass is arrested in Boston for wearing pants. I guess they would have preferred she didn't wear pants. 1862, Battle of Chickasaw Bayou. Confederate Army defeats General Sherman. Also on this date in 1862, the bowling ball is invented. 1867, the first telegraph ticker used by a brokerage house. That's Grusbeck and Company in New York. 1891, Edison patents a transmission of signals electrically. That's a radio for everybody else. 1895, Dr. L.S. Jameson begins a failed raid on Johannesburg. 1899, the British fleet seizes the German Imperial mail steamer Bundesrath. It was accused of carrying contraband. 1900, General Vigeon surprise attacks the British garrison in Helvetia. 1902, The Entertainer, one of the several piano ride compositions copyrighted for Scott Joplin by the U.S. Copyright Office, was copyrighted on this date. 1903, French Equatorial Africa celebrates into the countries of Gabon, Chad, and Ubangi-Shari. 1908, the patent is granted on a four-wheel automobile brake in Clintonville, Wisconsin. This day in 1911, the San Francisco Symphony is formed. 1913, on this date, the first movie serial premieres in Chicago. It was called The Adventures of Kathlyn. 1920, Yugoslav government bans the Communist Party. 1922, the revised Netherlands law proclaims universal suffrage. 1929, Dutch colonial authorities arrest Sukarno and other key PNI leaders in Java. Sukarno went on to become the first president of Indonesia. In 1933 was a red letter day in movies. Sons of the Desert, directed by William Snyder, stars Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. Let's see. In 1937, Lou Thesz beat Everett Marshall in St. Louis to win the NWA World Heavyweight title. He was the youngest ever professional wrestler to win the title. I saw him wrestle a few times before he retired. He must have been a hell of a wrestler in his younger days, because he was pretty good when I saw him. 1939, the first flight of the Consolidated B-24 Liberator bomber prototype took place. 1940, the worst German air raid on London took place, as over 10,000 bombs, including the first incendiary bombs, were dropped on the city of London as part of the Blitz. Even Buckingham Palace was bombed. 1944, Belgian Walloon Nazi collaborator Léon Delgrelle is sentenced to death. 1947, a ship carrying Jewish immigrants is driven away from Palestine. 1948, Canada recognizes Israel's right to exist. 1948, U.S. State Department announces work on placing objects into Earth orbit. 1949, Hungary nationalizes its industries. 1958, TV soap opera Young Dr. Malone debuts. I remember my grandmother used to watch that. 1965, Thunderball, the fourth James Bond film starring Sean Connery and Claudine O'Gear, premieres in Tokyo. 1967, Star Trek's Trouble with Tribbles first airs. That was a very well-watched episode. Well, we have come to the end of our little history segment. I'm going to go back to talking about shadow people. Maybe. Possibly. Okay. Shadow people may or may not be ghosts. There are those that say that they are a separate life form. Now, this particular story came from a young lady who said it. Her story began with the birth of her baby. Now, life with the new baby was normal until his two-week checkup. Doctor decided something wasn't right and did some extra tests, and after the blood work, they immediately rushed to the children's hospital. Now, they had a night of blood transfusions and tests, and finally they were allowed to go home. They found out later on if it had been one day late for his checkup, it would have been too late since his hemoglobin count was so low. He wouldn't have made it another day without a blood transfusion. Now, the problem was the doctors didn't know what was wrong. And there was no diagnosis. And they lived with no diagnosis for a while, and finally they found out what was wrong with the baby. It was called Diamondback Fan Anemia. So there were numerous blood transfusions and hospital stays, and they had to arrange for a bone marrow transplant. Now, as time went on, the mother began to realize there was another presence in the house. The husband worked nights, and she was home alone. And when she'd wake up to feed her baby, she'd take him to the kitchen to warm up his bottle, and quite often she'd see a dark hooded shadow leave the bedroom and go down the hall to the son's room. She described it as solid, dark black, and very tall. It reached from the floor to the ceiling and seemed to float as it moved. Now, she had the feeling it was male, but clearly it wasn't human, and she didn't think it ever had been, and it didn't really frighten her. And she had a thought occurred to her as though somebody was speaking, that somebody's coming to help him, or any alternative, help him over. As time went on, she saw this dark figure every night, and occasionally even saw him during the day, always out of the corner of her eye. Now, at no time did she feel frightened, and she always had the impression that it was trying to tell her that someone is coming to help. So they had an appointment coming up to meet with the bone marrow transplant team, so when the time came, they knew what to expect. And as this appointment got closer, she saw this figure more and more. Sometimes she'd see him several times a day. And unbeknownst to her, her twin sister was having the same experiences at her house during the same time frame. Now, at the time, the sister baby was 2 years old. That's when her nephew was born. And the sisters always helped each other. In fact, she was like a second mother to her sister's 2-year-old baby. So when the sister had her child, the 2-year-old's mother tried to be there for her because she knew how much it means to have somebody else help take care of your baby. And she always treated the nephew like her own baby in every way. So when he started having health problems, she was worried and did her best to help. And during this time, she was home alone with her own son a lot. And every once in a while, she'd see a shadow out of the corner of her eye. Now, when she said a shadow, it wasn't a shadow of a person. It was very tall. It came from the floor to the ceiling, very skinny. And she had the feeling that it was a living entity, but it wasn't a human. And somehow she knew it was there because of her nephew. It always seemed to appear when she was thinking about her nephew and his medical problems. And if you've ever had to worry about somebody, you know that any time you have a free moment, your thoughts turn to that person. Now, like her sister, whenever she'd see this shadow, she wouldn't be afraid. She began to wonder if that shadow was there to help him or in some fashion. You'd think being home alone with a 2-year-old and seeing something unexplainable would be frightening, but it never frightened her. She'd see this shadow during the night, during the day, literally at almost any time. One day, her nephew was at the hospital again, so his thoughts were with him throughout the day, and she and her son were watching cartoons during the afternoon when she saw the shadow right in front of her. Looked up to see it peeking around the corner at her. This was the first and only time she ever saw it straight on. Every other time it was out the corner of her eye. So to her, there was no denying the fact that it was there to help her nephew in some fashion. Now, the two sisters always told each other everything. So, both found it strange later they didn't tell each other about seeing this shadow figure. One day when they were talking, the aunt, the sister who had the two-year-old, said, "You know, I keep seeing this shadow." And her sister said, "Well, so have I. It's tall." She said, "Yeah, it goes up to the ceiling. It's black and skinny." Well, they had no idea to that moment that they had been seeing the very same shadow at each of their houses all these months. Well, as the appointment with the doctor to meet the bone marrow transplant team got drew closer, each of them seemed to be seeing the shadow more frequently. And that was making them nervous. Was it there to help them, the baby get better, or maybe to take him to the other side? The day of the appointment was a typical visit. The baby had all the same blood tests and blood work done that day that he had on the other visits. Doctors had been asking the same questions every time, but this appointment was coming to a close. The doctor stopped in mid-sentence, turned his head as if he was listening to someone who was speaking in his ear. And then he said, "Let's do one more test," and walked out of the room. Well, they waited for the new test results. The doctor came back and said, "Well, we were wrong. We think it's something else and not diamondback black fan anemia. We think it's hereditary spirocytosis." Now, hereditary spirocytosis still requires blood transfusions. Other issues could arise, but it's definitely a better diagnosis than diamond black fan anemia, since diamond black fan anemia eventually turns into cancer. Now, the argument could be made the initial diagnosis was wrong, but the two sisters had the feeling everything had actually changed that day. After this appointment, neither saw the black figure again. And even though it was a dark black shadow that most people would believe was a negative presence, they both felt it was a positive energy that had come to help the baby through this life event. Now, you have to wonder whether or not shadow people are actually evil, or maybe there are different types, just like there are different types of humans. And the answer to the question of whether or not they're evil is not as clear-cut as you might think. Clearly, there are different agendas furthered by different hooded figures. And to make matters more confusing, some hooded figures may not exactly be what you think they are and may have a good reason for appearing. Kathy Gash wrote a book called My Life Amidst the Paranormal. She reported the helping hand of a hooded figure at the ruins of a 16th century friary called Slane Hill in Ireland. Now, as she told the story, she thought it was dangerous footing going up because the ruins was on top of a hill, but it was worse going down with nothing to hold on to. And she'd gone no more than a third of the way when she realized she was coming to the worst section of the tower with the stairs covered with moss. So she braced herself and decided to go down one step at a time, sitting on her rear end. You sit on the step, put your feet down, sit on the step, put your feet down. You do it one step at a time. It's a tedious way to go down a set of steps or up a set of steps, but it appears to be safer. There were so many steps her end would slip and she'd come down on the lower step with a thud. She was almost to the bottom, could see daylight, no more than 15 steps to go. So she decided the worst was over, and she got up and decided to walk down, which she discovered was a big mistake. She had no sooner stood up when the heel of her right shoe slipped, her left leg buckled, and she hit her back on the step. She could see the wall getting close to her face. The balance was completely gone. Just as she thought she was going to go down the remaining steps on her back, something grabbed her right elbow and left shoulder blade, and she stopped slipping.
She said that touch was firm but gentle and wouldn't let go till she managed to get her balance back. Now, she was stunned that her fall had been stopped. So she looked behind to see who was there that had caught her, but there was no one there. Managed to get herself seated firmly on the steps and check for injuries. Her hands were red from being scraped on the rock and her leg ache from being twisted, and she could hear her heart beating in her ears. In fact, she started shaking when she realized she could have been seriously injured with a long way to go for help. Somehow she managed to get back on her feet, but decided to be safer for her to go down the last few steps, sitting on her butt again. Just as she sat down, she heard the muffled sound of soft-soled shoes going up the steps behind her. She craned her neck and looked behind her, but there was no one there. And knowing that there was no way that anybody could be in the tower and get ahead of her in order to be behind her, she decided the only explanation was she had been saved by a ghost. Go back up the steps, still hearing the footsteps, and smiled her thanks. She finally got to the last step and walked her limped away out of the tower and met up with her sister. After they got to the car, told her that she had slipped, didn't think that she should drive, and at first the sister was angry that she had risked her life climbing the tower. But she explained that somebody had grabbed and prevented her from going ass over tea kettle. She turned pale. She said that after she had yelled to her from the top of the tower, she had seen somebody walking in the bell area below her. Well, she told her nobody could have been walking on that level because there's no floor to walk on. But she insisted she had seen somebody wearing a hoodie. And it bothered her because her sister was up there by herself. She tried to reassure her that nobody else was in that tower with her, at least nobody alive anyway. Well, even though her leg was hurting, she told her she'd be right back and left her way back to the tower. She stood at the bottom of the steps and yelled, "Thank you, you may have saved my life." As she turned to walk away, she heard someone say something to her in Latin, or maybe Gaelic. All she knew was they acknowledged her gratitude. Well, her sister reluctantly got behind the wheel and turned onto the main road, and even though she was in pain, the sister had gone up into the tower. Thought this was actually a wonderful experience. Even though the friary had been abandoned since the early 1700s, she believed it was a kindly friar and monk who still roamed the ground, taking the duties of protecting those around them very seriously. Well, this story shows another shadow entity being helpful rather than harmful. And this particular hooded figure was probably exactly what the explorer thought it was, the ghost of a friar or a monk. That it manifested enough to appear hooded to her sister's eyes is rather significant. Now, what if your hooded figure entity is so monk-like you also hear chanting along with its appearance? What if that appearance is also made by three of them? Now you've got a situation similar to the three men in black. Such was the case for author and cartoonist Lacey Lemke when she woke to find three hooded figures standing over her bed. Now, according to the cartoonist, she was in a partial state of sleep paralysis. It's always interesting when the folks that are so frantic to let you know that the warranty on your car has expired that they call at all hours. I get dozens of these calls a day. And no matter what you do, you can't get them to stop. Going back to Lacey Lemke. She was in a partial state of sleep paralysis. That's when you wake up and you can't move. I mean, she was still able to move her head from side to side, so the paralysis wasn't complete. And her recollection of the incident is rather vivid, describing the hooded figures as wearing brown robes with large sleeves, but their hands were black, as were their faces. Completely black no features could be determined. The hooded figure in the middle held out his arms as if he were reading a book, but his robes were so large she couldn't tell whether he may actually have been holding something. They continued to chant over her body in a style that she thought was Gregorian, a type of chanting developed and used in Western and Central Europe during the 9th and 10th century by the Roman Catholic Church. She said the experience felt to her like it lasted 30 minutes, but could have just as well lasted only a few. Without any warning, the three figures suddenly vanished. Well, the account is extremely surreal and almost sounds like something out of an Exorcist horror movie. Were these hooded figures the spirits of real monks conducting the ceremonies they once had done long ago, or were they some sort of interdimensional beings chanting and performing a ritual for some unknown reason? See, these are the type of questions you're left with after you have an encounter such as this. Then, there have also been folks who've seen what's termed the mist. Now, it's a black mist or a cloud or a black smoke. I mean, they're all different terms for very similar phenomena. The vaporous manifestation of a shadowy entity. It can roll into a room out of a hallway. It can appear in a corner, even rise up out of the floor. And there's no one specific form for this type of shadow. This shadow has no real form to it. It materializes into almost any shape it likes, then dematerializes into nothing. Now, one of the investigators that I've read about had a prolific experience with the mist during one of the investigations I conducted at a house in Edmond, Oklahoma. This investigation was later shown on an episode of The Haunted, which was broadcast on Animal Planet in 2011. Now, since it was developed for Animal Planet, it targeted storytelling model around the animals at the haunted location, how they reacted to paranormal activity. Now, most episodes of this show were actually very animal-centric, but in this particular episode, the story revolved around the humans that lived in the house when it aired, and it became one of the most compelling and widely received episodes of the entire series. So the production company actually achieved a coup with it. As demonologist Carl Johnson later said, it was a story that could have used a two-hour episode. And an important segment concerning one of the cats and the shadow entity was scrapped and only exists now as a deleted scene that was included on the DVD the production company gave to the family. Now, they investigated the Edmond house five or six times before they filmed the cleansing night with the demonologist. And during one of these investigations, the cat started acting very skittish. She darted about the living room and dining room area, ventured into the kitchen at one point, looking back and forth, and eventually scampered into the bedroom doorway of the adult daughter. It was reporting most of the trouble with the entity with red eyes. This was a Talesian. We talked about that yesterday. And then the cat stopped dead in her tracks. The cat stopped because in the middle of that bedroom was a large black mass, almost cloud-like in nature. Everyone was startled because of the size of that black shadow. Now, the cat didn't want anything to do with it. She immediately backed off from the room, slithered around the corner under a chair, and ended up somewhere on the other side of the piano in the living room. And the investigators, of course, just stared at this thing hovering in the middle of the room. Now, when they said cloud-like, they meant just that. Just like any other misty vapor cloud you might see, almost like a small patch of fog hovering in your backyard, except it was solid black. As the investigator continued to stare, it began to slowly dissipate. They did get a couple of photographs of it, but the flash was activated on the camera, so it totally obliterated the shadow with its bright light. When the light subsided, the last remnants of the black mist were dissolving away. So the photograph actually showed just the bedroom. So clearly the lesson is, during a paranormal investigation, don't use the flash. Now, this wasn't a manifestation of an entity, especially the entity with red eyes that the young lady had been seeing in her closet. This seemed to be something else, some other sort of energy that tried to take form in her bedroom. Now, it's hard to say whether it was really even definitively negative in nature, although it certainly seemed ominous and heavy. There's no doubt the cat evacuated the area as soon as possible. Maybe standing in the doorway holding a camera was just the dumb human being a dumb human, not realizing what sort of nefarious entity could possibly be looming in the middle of the room. Now, certainly nothing malicious happened, and whatever was there was gone a few moments after it had been seen. Now, referring to the demonologist, he and his brother first investigated a place called the Perron House, the haunted farmhouse in which the movie The Conjuring is based. He encountered something very similar. Now, they're the ones that originally told Ed and Lorraine Warren about the infamous case. Carolyn Perron answered an ad, their paranormal investigative team, PIRO, that's the Parapsychology Investigative Research Organization, it put in the newspaper. But there is some controversy, since Carolyn states she never answered an ad in the paper, and the investigative team actually surprised the family when they showed up. So you have to ask yourself, did the house or something else in the universe reach out to the demonologist and beckon them to come, or was it a falsification? In any case, this is quite different from what the film depicts, and for a full account of the events that transpired during the 10 years the Perrons lived in the house, there's a book called The House of Darkness, House of Light. It was written by the family's oldest daughter, Andrea Perron. Prior to the Warren showing up to investigate, the demonologist and his brother visited several times to get a sense of the activity and see what they could do to help. Now, a lot of things happened during these visits, but one of the things that the demonologist witnessed was a black shadow without form on the second floor. And he discussed it in a phone call with an investigator. This is prior to the filming he and his brother conducted with Ghost Adventures, the episode that aired on Halloween 2019. Now, quite often, investigators believe they're dealing with something from another dimension. Maybe altered terrestrial, so to speak. And there's some very interesting books that have been published by some of these investigators. And while some, basically, they delve into areas that may seem a little bizarre, they do give a good picture of things that took place. Now, these ultra-terrestrials that are referred to can look basically like us, but unlike ghosts, human-generated spirits are not totally replicating as once living people. They just assume the human form, and they don't really look like us, which explains why some of them wear cloaks and hats and seem dressed. It's believed that these ultra-terrestrials see humans and figure that's the way humans dress, so that's how they dress when they appear. Now, that may or may not be true. When you're dealing in this area, there's a lot of ifs and maybes. When you deal with shadow people, shadow spirits, shadow ghosts, whatever you want to call them, really, you have to throw away everything you might have learned about the paranormal. They've been called demonic. They've been called ghost. But one thing is for sure, they're here. They're more substantial than most ghosts. They seem to have more substance. Shadow ghosts can actually occlude light. They walk in front of light. It's almost like the old shadow radio series. The only thing you can never hide is the shadow itself. Now, there is a house. It's at a place called Round Top Farm. And the owners have discussed some of the things that they run into. According to one of the owners, they've had everything from shadow figures and black mist and doors opening and closing. It's like everything you ever heard about the paranormal. It all happens at once. And in the first 4 months they were there, they were inundated with paranormal activity. They also discussed instances of black smoke. Their son saw it on a whole separate occasion. It was enough for him to say, yeah, I've had enough, and he went back home. They couldn't get him to come back. During a follow-up interview, following the airing of the return to the farmhouse on the Travel Channel, one of the brother of the demonologist said, I knew there was a very, very vicious controlling entity in the house. It was the same one he happened to deal with when he was a teenager the first time he came to that house back in the 70s. And he had to be in the same room with his brother to make sure everything was all right and to pray over him in case things got out of control, which they do appear to do at certain times. During the filming of the paranormal investigation, the demonologist was sitting at a table on the first floor, and suddenly he went into a trance-like state when he kept muttering, don't leave, don't leave, don't leave. It wasn't a conscious thought, he said later. It wasn't volitional at all, unless it was stemming from his subconscious. He wasn't willing it. He was letting it speak, whatever it was. When it said, don't leave, it was talking to the people in the room. And there was a sort of desperation, he said, in the cry. What he was feeling was that it didn't want the people to leave. It didn't want them to leave the house. When he got up, he felt like he donated blood or something. He was actually staggering when he left his chair. Well, as I've said many times, quite often, paranormal entities may not stem from the house or anything that happened there. It may stem from the land and perhaps a building that stood there before. Then there's the Black Wisp, which possibly could account for most of the shadow people that have been encountered. These are entities that are tall, narrow, and very translucent, and very fast. They almost look as somebody hit fast forward button on something wearing dark clothing, and the image moves so fast you could barely see it. You knew something was there, but you really couldn't tell what it was. Now, some of these wisps look as if a human shadow had picked itself off the ground, stood upright. But just for a brief moment in the corner of your eye before it darts away just as soon as you turn to look at it, a number of these have been reported on paranormal investigations over the years. One investigator said the first one he encountered was when he was 13 in Ohio. And it was certainly the most solid of any of the entities he could classify as a wisp. He was unpacking his belongings in his new bedroom and he kept seeing something standing in the hallway right at his doorway. But each time he'd look at it, it would dart away. He said this being was dark, and it was like his first shadow person encounter, so he really couldn't discern any distinguishable features. And he could tell it had a head and a body, but that was about it. Otherwise, moved too quickly each time he looked, and while it peeked in the doorway often, he just couldn't make out any of the details besides body shape. You know, when I was a teenager, my parents bought a new house, first house built on that particular piece of property. This was in Macon, Georgia. Well, I found out that the property was on the edge of what had been an Indian village back in the 1700s. And where the house was built was where those who died would be put up on scaffolding.
I call it scaffolding. They have a name for it, and I don't remember what it is. But I started having, I guess you can call it visitations. There was a green light about the size of a silver dollar that floated around the room. Fish would disappear out of my aquarium, and I'd find them wrapped up in my clothes in the drawers of the dresser up which the aquarium sat. When the green light went down behind my TV, it quit working in that room. It would work any place else, but not in that room. Nobody saw it but me until one night when it appeared. I called my parents, and they came in and saw it. And it went down behind the bedroom door, which is where my father was standing. And he flipped on the light, jerked open the door, and there was, of course, nothing there. Now, when anyone else would stay in that room, there'd be no visitation. When I'd be there, the green light would come back. We never did find an answer to it. I can only assume it had something to do with that old village. The people across the street had some interesting encounters. They never found a rational explanation for it either. It's interesting to note that quite often these entities pick out certain people and they're the ones that they spend time with. Almost like they're begging for your attention. It was living there that I first became seriously interested in UFOs. And there were a few strange lights seen. The area where the main village had been was still woods. And while I never explored it, looking back, I wonder why I didn't. But certainly, it was a most unusual time and a most unusual house. We've come to the end of today's show. We'll be back tomorrow. When, once again, you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall on The Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, y'all have a truly great evening. And get ready for a Happy New Year.